Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, President Bush has arrived in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Well, he will surely once again caution Russian leader Vladimir Putin about interfering with the young pro-Western democracies struggling to free themselves from Moscow's influence. But Presidents Bush and Putin put aside their recent criticism of one another earlier today. The two attended a lavish ceremony in Moscow marking the 60th anniversary of the Allied victory over Nazi Germany. Joining us on the line from Moscow is Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor. Fred, can you start by telling us, what is President Bush hoping to achieve in his visit to Georgia?
Well, I think that there are momentous processes underway in the former Soviet Union, and we've seen several upheavals, some call them revolutions, and the first one of those was in Georgia, then it spread to Ukraine, and a month ago or so we had another similar event in Kyrgyzstan. Things are changing here. There are winds sweeping over the region, and to a large extent, or some one aspect of that is distancing themselves, these former Soviet republics, from Moscow and trying to lean in a more westward direction toward Europe and indeed the United States. And I think George Bush had this very much on his mind in all three of his destinations in the former Soviet Union this weekend.
And in fact, we understand that two Baltic nations, Estonia and Lithuania, shunned invitations to today's ceremony because they called Russia an occupier and not the liberator that Putin has characterized the country as.
Well, yeah, those republics were independent before World War II and were the subject of a secret Nazi-Soviet pact which accorded them to the Soviet Union in 1939. And they want Russia to repudiate that pact. And at least under Putin, Russia is a little too proud to say that what they want. And this has led to the issue becoming fairly brisk in the last few days.
And President Bush, in fact, referred to Soviet tyranny and authoritarianism in the five decades following World War II when he visited Latvia, one of the Baltic states occupied by the Soviet Union after the war. That apparently angered Putin. But did he make any such comments when he actually got to Russian soil?
Well, we don't know. He did meet privately with Putin last night, that is on Sunday night, at Putin's dacha outside of Moscow, and we don't have a record of what they said, but Bush apparently said he did raise his criticisms, not only about that, but about the authoritarian drift which is taking place in Russia under Putin himself.
But no formal press conference, which some would say is unusual.
I think everybody agreed to put their disagreements aside for today's celebration, which was largely scripted by Putin. But it is in honor of a tremendous event, you know, the Soviet achievement, the sacrifices, the huge cost that the Soviet Union paid to defeat Nazi Germany. I think everybody was willing, for one day at least, to just stand shoulder to shoulder and honor that.
We're going to talk more with analyst Marshall Goldman about what that sacrifice was. But what was the ceremony like? It sounded spectacular.
Well, it was. I mean, Putin does these things. He had a big celebration with 50 world leaders in St. Petersburg 2 years ago, and he seems to like it. He seems to see it as politically useful. There was a reviewing stand on Red Square, just in the Soviet style, and across the square marched most of the Moscow garrison, about 7,000 troops, some of them in World War II uniforms, and about 3,000 war veterans also marched across, and there was a parade of vintage trucks and armor. It was really wonderful, and it was all topped with a flyby by modern Russian Air Force jets. Yeah, no, it was spectacular.
We understand that there isn't a family in modern-day Russia that wasn't affected by World War II, that didn't have a loss in World War II.
Well, they lost 15% of the population, and 8 out of every 10 Russians alive today is either a war veteran or descended from a war veteran.
Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us from Moscow. Fred, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And joining us now with a more in-depth look at relations between the U.S. and Russia, Marshall Goldman, Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. Marshall, welcome as always.
Thank you.
And we, as we've been seeing, both President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin are going out of their way to put a good face on this visit, cruising around in one of Putin's Volgas.
This was an attempt to copy the fact that when Putin visited the ranch, they drove around in one of Bush's cars. So this was really quite a spectacle.
Well, and it came after there was a lot of assumption that there was going to be a tense meeting between the two and a tense conversation between the two. Over what? Remind us.
Over a lot of things. And that also explains Bush's itinerary. Complaining, first of all, the fact that at the end of World War II, which should have been a celebration for everyone, this marked the beginning of the inclusion within the Soviet Union of the Baltic states and also suppression of Eastern Europe. In a sense, the Soviet Union under Stalin took over those countries and ended their freedom, so it was not liberation. Mm-hmm. For them, this really was a period of domination.
And, of course, Putin has responded, Latvia and other countries invited us in.
Well, that's what he says, and that's the official statement, although, of course, there's another issue here as well. And that is that there was criticism of the fact that in August 1939, the Soviet Union joined with Germany under Hitler, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, to announce an alliance, which then really set the stage for the beginning of World War II. In other words, Russia, the Soviet Union, joined up with Germany against France, England, and the other West European countries.
And remind us why comments, for instance, of President Bush speaking from Latvia, seeming to warn Vladimir Putin to let these democracies thrive. Remind us how much these comments sting in modern-day Russia. How much the Soviet Union suffered because of the Nazis?
Well, they lost, the official estimate is that they lost 27 million lives in World War II. Now, you know, we in the West think our countries played an important role, and we did. But we sometimes forget the fact that for the Russian ordinary people, the battle was fought on their territory. And certainly, if it was not 27 million people who died, it was pretty close to that. So the Russians think that they're the ones who turned the tide, and particularly at the Battle of Stalingrad, began to push the Germans back all the way to Berlin.
And they still, today, they do. I mean, I think Putin even remarked in the last few days that, you know, Americans forget what happened and what the Russians did.
We do tend to forget. They, of course, also tend to forget that we provided them with a good deal of military aid, which they needed because of the fact that much of their industry had been destroyed. But Putin still, and most Russians, I think, still feel that the Soviet Union was important and that Russian dominance of that was important. And that's why just a few weeks ago, Putin said the collapse of the Soviet Union, the disintegration of the Soviet Union, was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, which I don't think many of us would agree with, but that's how he sees it. And so he still has this longing, as it were, to do something to bring back, as it were, Ukraine, Belarus, and Belarus and Russia already have an alliance, but also the Baltic states and parts of the Caucasus where Georgia is located. There still is this feeling that Russia, which used to be a superpower and now is not, both a superpower economically and militarily, has suffered in the aftermath of the breakup. And that's why Russia continues to interfere in Georgia. That's why Saakashvili, the president, the new president of Georgia, did not go to the ceremonies in Moscow. And that's why Russia still has three military bases on Georgian territory, which Saakashvili wants to get rid of. And President Bush's visit there tomorrow is an indication of that. We support Saakashvili in trying to get the troops out.
How correct is the Bush administration in admonishing Vladimir Putin for, you know, backsliding on democracy? Give us some of the examples.
It's really rather depressing. Putin has abolished the direct election of governors throughout 89 provinces. He's also announced that half the members of the Duma who previously were elected by their constituents in the region, like we elect congressmen, will no longer be elected. They'll be put on a party list, and the party list will be determined by Putin.
How did Putin do that? Just decide that governors would no longer be elected, they'd be appointed?
He just decided. It's against the Constitution. He decided it and then announced that we'll have to change the Constitution, and it's just being changed. His argument was that he wanted to ensure that the governors were no longer corrupt. What he said is that when these people run for governor, they're corrupt. They buy the election. And some of that is true. But what makes Putin think that he will be able to pick people not corrupt? Indeed, we've seen some of the people that he's worked with are just as corrupt as anyone else you could find in Russia today.
How do people react?
for the most part, without a whimper, including the governors who are there. And the reason for that is most of the governors reason, well, I'll be nice to Putin and he'll reappoint me, which he has done. There was some criticism, was not unanimous, but very little criticism and certainly no demonstrations. And people just kind of took it, except for a very small group of intellectuals. There is no opposition party right now. That's the biggest problem. They have no standing in the Duma because you need 5% of the vote to have some standing, and nobody got 5% of the vote other than the communists and a nationalist party.
The Duma, the parliament.
The parliament.
But, you know, it seems as if every time someone criticizes a move that Putin makes, he holds up a mirror and flashes it back at you. He said to Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes, but India doesn't elect their governors either, and they're a democracy.
Well, worse than that, he said, you know, what role, you talk about democracy in the United States, look at your election in the year 2000. The election was decided by the courts and the Electoral College. By implication, is who really won the election in the year 2000 when Bush did not have the majority of votes. It was Gore who had more votes. Putin is no dummy. You know, he's very, very smart, very fast. And, you know, this is a legitimate criticism. There are nuances that are there. And so he will stand up and defend himself.
What happened here? How did President George Bush return from his first meeting and say he looked in this man's eyes and saw his soul and saw someone he could work with?
It turned out that President Bush read a little book. And in the book, President Putin says that he was secretly baptized in the Soviet period by his mother and grandmother. In 1993, he went to Israel, to Jerusalem, and his mother gave him a wooden cross and said, when you get to Jerusalem, have it blessed by the Orthodox priest. Putin describes this in the book. In preparation, as I said, Bush read this. And so when they met in 2001 for the first time at that meeting, Bush said, tell me about the cross. And Putin did. And it was at that point that he said he looked into his eyes and saw his got a sense of his soul. Nothing to do with politics. It was for a born-again Christian, the fact that Putin wore the cross suggested to Bush that indeed here was a soulmate.
When in fact?
Well, in fact, there's some question just about how observant Putin is, but he does go to church. Some say he does this not out of conviction, but out of politics. But in any case, that there is this that if, for more than anything else, that explains the bond between these two men.
Marshall Goldman, Russian specialist at the Davis Center at Harvard University. When we come back, are President Bush's warnings to Vladimir Putin too late? Marshall has just returned from Russia. He says that Putin's days as president may be numbered. There's more coming up here and now. We've been talking about U.S.-Russia relations today as President Bush has left Moscow and is now in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Bush has criticized Vladimir Putin for his heavy-handedness in the affairs of the former republics and rolling back reforms in Russia. Our guest is Marshall Goldman of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. And Marshall, by all accounts, Vladimir Putin inherited a mess in Russia. Explain to us the rise of the oligarchs in Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union.
I've written a good deal about it. And there was a feeling that after the collapse of the Soviet Union was really in very perilous times. The treasury was empty. They had almost no supplies of food. The shelves were empty. Remember seeing those pictures of empty shelves. And so the feeling was we've got to move quickly, otherwise the communists are going to come back. And the way to move quickly is to give people a sense of ownership, make them stakeholders. And so we'll privatize everything. What happened, however, is that they move so quickly without controls that the wealth of the country, in terms of oil fields and oil companies, which all belong to the state, suddenly were transformed and turned over to a very small group of what have become oligarchs. So what happened is at one point you had one of the oligarchs boast that seven of them controlled 50% of the country's assets. That was an exaggeration. But what made it particularly important was that at the same time these small group of people were seizing assets, the country's economy was shrinking to half of its size. Mm-hmm. The GDP fell to half of what it was. So you had this situation where a very few rich were taking a larger and larger share of a shrinking pie. And this, of course, caused enormous anger, and particularly because the oligarchs did not exactly play by the rules that we should expect in that kind of situation. There was no rule of law.
Well, and fast forward to recent history, the firing of the head of the oil company.
Well, not only firing, the imprisonment, right. Tax evasion and everything else, which is kind of an echo of that, where Putin said, okay, we've got to solve this problem, we've got to redress the abuses, and we've got to respond to public criticism that only a very few benefited at the expense of the multitudes.
And so how did the Bush administration react to that?
President Bush has very mixed emotions about that. There's a realization that the laws were liberally interpreted and that things were bad, and the state has used really very unfair methods to move in that direction. But also there's the feeling this man has been in, Khodorkovsky, the owner of Yukos, has been in jail since October 2003. We're used to, in this country, arresting businessmen too, mm-hmm. But we let them out on bail. Khodorkovsky's not been out on bail, and it's clear that the judge is really following the orders that come from the Kremlin. There is no such thing as rule of law. At best, it's rule of laws, and at worst, it's rule of in-laws. So in this case, Putin and his fellow rulers. If you talk to Putin, and I was with a small group that met with him in September, Putin insists that, indeed, this is democratic, what he's doing. This is democracy. It's just a different version. And that's why he responds to Bush when Bush brings up these issues by saying, well, tell me, what makes you so democratic when the Electoral College determines who's the president?
What's your sense, Marshall Goldman? Is this indeed perhaps the only form of democracy that can be instituted in Russia and its former republics now?
That's a hard question. I'd like to think that it's not the only form, but it really gets to the issue. I think given Russia's cultural traditions, it is easy to slip back into this kind of thing and easy to say, well, the Russians need a strong leader. But I think that they indeed need diversity as much as any other society does. And it certainly could do better. If you look at the Baltic states, they're doing better. If you look even at Ukraine right now, it's doing better. And I there's no reason in my mind why you have to fall back into the arms of the KGB, as seems to be happening.
Given all of this, given that Putin is seen as rolling back democracy, we spoke about the oil industry, but also the press.
Well, he's also taken over control of all the major television networks. They're all under the control, and he's encroaching more and more on the newspapers. There are still some newspapers that are independent and very critical, but each day the number seems to shrink. More than that, if you're an owner of one of these newspapers, you self censor yourself, because you just realize that if not, the state will take you over, and you figure, well, you'd better compromise. It's really scary. But that makes it some very interesting change in atmosphere. I mean, I was just there, and for the first time I really had the feeling that the system was in a process of uncertainty, that what has happened in Ukraine, what has happened in Georgia, where the leadership was thrown out, and we would like to think a more democratic form of leadership took over, there is some sense that maybe Putin would even be vulnerable in this kind of way. And I can tell you that the people around Putin are worried that this could happen. And that explains, again, why they're trying to move more and more to control. It's a fascinating process intellectually. You do away with the elections. So what happens if the people in the region are unhappy? How can they protest? They can't throw out the governor by electing a new governor, so they go out on the street.
Let's remind people, these are the elections for governors, and
Putin
has decided to appoint the governors.
That's right.
And been much criticized for that. So, as you say, they go into the street
and
protest.
So they go on the street, and so then they have to do something about preventing people from going into the street. Once the process begins to move backward, to move in the wrong direction, you have to increase the controls to make sure that, again, you don't have an untoward event.
So, Marshall Goldman, what are you saying, coming back from a recent trip to Russia? Are you saying that Putin's in danger of being overthrown or voted out?
The election for president won't take place until 2008 on their term limits. So by the Constitution, he's not supposed to run again. And so far, he's given no indication that he would. But it could mean that there could be pressure to make him backtrack on some of these things, and indeed even force him to leave prematurely, or in any case, prepare for the 2008 election, because at this point, there's no opposition, and to try to at least generate some opposition to the Putin and his dominant party.
Marshall Goldman, Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University, also author of the new book, The Piratization of Russia. It's an examination of the country's oligarchs that we spoke of. Marshall, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, Jane Fonda on her life so far. And still to come today, banjoist Alison Brown, former backup for bluegrass superstar Alison Krauss, now on her own, but joined by a lot of friends, including the Indigo Girls.
I'm sitting in a railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one-night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand. Every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Now, over the weekend, hundreds gathered in Kansas City, Missouri to remember Erica Green, the 3-year-old found naked and beheaded 4 years ago, but only identified last week. The identification of the little girl known as Precious Doe is a victory for one community activist whose efforts over the last 4 years, including placing ads in local newspapers, yielded a tip that led to the arrest of Erica's mother and stepfather. I spoke with activist Alonzo Washington last week after police made Erica's name public, and I asked him how he became involved in this story.
When it first broke in Kansas City, it was one of those stories that was in the back of the news. I took a look at the case and said, you know, this is appalling. And I decided to do an early morning press conference in front of the crime scene, you know, asking the community to come out and back this case. Nobody should be able to throw away a child like trash in our city. And from that day, you know, a big movement started. But we didn't have answers. You know, we had a number of other children that were identified but never closed the case. And so it dragged on and on and on. And, you know, I just kept up the efforts to try to make sure no one forgot about this child.
Well, even 4 years later, I mean, we understand the case was concluded because in early April you put another ad in a largely African-American read newspaper in that area, and someone came forward.
Yes, I mean, and it was just miraculous that that took place, because people began to speculate that this would be a case that would never be solved. They began to, you know, you get criticisms and, you know, opinion pages, and Alonzo Washington's obsessed, you know, he's just seeking attention. So I almost did not do the 4-year anniversary prayer vigil, almost didn't even run the ad.
Yeah, tell me about that, because the ad was calling for another vigil on the, was it April 28th anniversary?
This is a child. I am a father of 7, and if my child was out there, I want to have someone advocating for her. So I said, I'm just going to do this regardless. And lo and behold, 2 days after the vigil, the tip comes in to me.
Now, we understand this tipster is a relative of the little girl, and he called police last year with information, and he told you that he tried to call police a few days after your ad, but they told him to come back after the weekend. So he came to you with this information. Is that correct?
He tried to give it to him, and he just said they won't believe me.
And can you tell us what the tip was?
Well, the tip was a number of things. You know, her name was Erica Green, the name of the mother, the rumors around them beating the child in a house in Kansas City.
He told you all of this.
He told me every last detail that has come out on the case, and it was a battle of, you know, disproving or proving his statements. You know, the police said their investigation stopped here in Kansas City after they accounted for all her children. There was only one problem. They accounted for 5 children. I was able to ascertain that there were 8. They also were telling me, well, Alonzo, you know, there is no record for an Erica Green. Now, I have found out that this mother had a large amount of suitors, men in her life, and, you know, this child was young, not in school, so it'd be kind of hard to document him. And I said, well, you know, I think we should do some more digging on this.
Well, we understand that early on the police had even spoken with Erica's mother. Of course, they didn't know it was her at the time. Now they've matched DNA samples and they've charged the girl's mother and stepfather, Michelle and Harold Johnson, with murder. They're saying that Johnson kicked the little girl in the head and that they didn't take her to the doctor because they both had outstanding warrants for arrest. She died 10 hours later. Alonzo Washington, this was a little black girl.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that factored into the fact that for many people it faded from the headlines?
Oh, that, without a doubt. Had this been, I mean, it was so many, I mean, this wasn't the only mistake that the police made. When the body was found without the head, you know, the police said they searched the field, okay? They found the body. I go out, do a press conference, and ask volunteers to look, you know, for more clues and all of that. 2 hours later, a man finds the head. Now, I do not think this could have occurred in a suburb if you would have found a little white child in the suburbs, you know, decapitated. But, you know, the good thing is that, you know, we decided to never give up on it, continue to pursue it, and now we have resolution, and maybe this will change things.
Alonzo Washington, a Kansas City community activist, his work on the Precious Doe case helped police identify the girl. Alonzo, thanks for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
And we want to bring in Captain Rich Lockhart. He's a spokesperson for the Kansas City Police Department. Captain Lockhart, we know that all of Kansas City has been grieving this child, but do you think that police did everything they could to solve the crime?
We certainly think that we did. You have to remember that there are 25 detectives over the 4 years of this investigation that have looked at this case, and one sergeant has been in charge of this case from the beginning, and he has lived this case from the beginning. He has been to the autopsies, to the crime scenes. If anyone wanted to solve this case, it was that sergeant.
Then why did he turn the tipster away for that one weekend and tell him to come back on Monday?
Well, we didn't turn the tipster away. We got a call from the tipster on Friday. We started doing background information and gathering facts here to try and substantiate some of what he was telling us. And when we discovered that some of what he was telling us was starting to check out, we immediately sent two detectives down to Muskogee, Oklahoma, to make face-to-face contact and investigate further.
Now, so let us understand this, because we understand this same tipster came forward a year earlier, and the police had spoken to Erica's mother, in fact, had knocked on her door much earlier in the investigation, but the police thought that she had five children and all were accounted for, when she actually had, as we now know, more children than that.
Last year, we did get a call from Harold Johnson's grandfather, and he relayed some information to us, pretty general information about how he thought that Precious Doe, as she was known then, might be one of the kids that his son's or his grandson's girlfriend had. We didn't know where Michelle Johnson was, and neither did the grandfather. We investigated that tip as far as we could. A number of her children, Michelle Johnson's children, were in protective custody in Oklahoma. We checked with the Child Service Agency there. We were able to verify the whereabouts of some of them, but not all of them. And so we exhausted the lead as far as we could. And he didn't have all of the information then that he was able to provide to us this last time when he called. Mm. And when he called this last time, the information he gave us was much more detailed, and then start investigating it again, and within just a few hours be able to solve this case.
Mm-hmm. What is your sense overall of how well the police did? Because, as you know, there are some who feel that, and Alonzo Washington is one of them, that because this little girl is a black child, it raised less concern.
I would have to disagree with that 100%. The detectives that are involved in this case don't look at race. They don't look at sex. They just look at a victim. And when it's a child victim, it is the reason that detectives want to be detectives, because they want to solve that case more than anything. And we have, over the last 4 years, I think, done just about everything a police department could do to try and solve this case.
Captain Rich Lockhart is a spokesperson for the police department in Kansas City, Missouri. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. This week, the U.S. Senate is expected to pass the Real ID Act, which would set federal standards for issuing state driver's licenses. Its authors call it an anti-terrorism measure, but many critics call it anti-immigration, partly because of strict new documentation requirements. And state governments responsible for implementing most of the changes call it unworkable. Shai Calvo is Transportation Committee Director at the National Conference of State Legislatures. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes.
Mr. Calvo, I know that your group is opposed to this measure. Why don't you explain why?
Well, state legislators have been committed to improving the security of driver's licenses since 9/11. I've been working very hard across the country to do that. However, with the 9/11 Commission, I think there was a widespread understanding that we needed a federal standard to ensure that all driver's licenses met a basic threshold. So in December, as part of the intelligence bill, Congress collectively enacted a process to create federal standards, but that process relied on a special task force of state and federal officials working together to come up with standards that will implement meaningful reforms in a way that will work, that will allow us to set priorities and do it in a cooperative way. Our problem with the Real ID Act is it actually dismantles that collaborative process that was set up in December and instead imposes rigid, very bureaucratic federal standards unilaterally.
Are state officials concerned that the collaboration has been wrecked or that this proposal won't work?
Both. I mean, part of this bill is it's very rigid and prescriptive. It gets into the details and things that probably aren't best written into federal statute. Things that, you know, requiring states to verify utility bills and federal standards for security at state office buildings that produce these things. And those are 3,000 offices around the country. So, I mean, one-size-fits-all standards for such things, we think, is ill-advised and would rather a collaborative process that focuses on the critical function. We need to make sure that people are who they say they are.
Let's, for people unfamiliar with the legislation, explain what would be required under it. When people go to get a first-time driver's license or renew their existing driver's licenses, you'll have to present as many as 4 forms of identification.
Actually, at least 4, but it doesn't stop then. States are going to have to make copies of those documents and keep them on file for 10 years. They're then going to have to literally verify each one of those documents with the issuing agency. So they're going to have to contact. If electronic means are available, terrific, but in most cases, they're going to have to call. Pick up the phone and call your birth records, you know, agency that may be in a different state. Call your utility company or your mortgage company, and there's this tremendous time and cost that comes with making those connections.
Are you going to be able to get your license the same day that you're there in line?
I think the ability of Americans to get the license in the same day, what is known as over-the-counter issuance, is probably much done under this bill. These states are going to have to take in these documents and then verify them over a period of time. It simply can't be done in one day. And if they tried to do it in one day, it would be a nightmare of a day.
Let me read you a quote from the author of the proposal, Congressman James Sensenbrenner, Republican from Wisconsin. Quote, "If someone has to stand in line for a few minutes more for a license, that's a small price to pay than having thousands or tens of thousands of people die in a terrorist attack." Respond to that.
I do agree that if this made people safer, they would support it. There's truth to that. However, what's disappointing is that this measure doesn't make people safer. He's really focusing on, you know, requiring driver's licenses for people who may not be in the country legally. But it's important to understand that all 19 of the 9/11 hijackers entered this country legally. They were not illegal aliens. They were people who came in through our troubled immigration system, and the federal government simply lost sight of them. The real reforms that implemented the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, they were adopted in December. And quite frankly, with state and federal officials working together in a cooperative way, they're going to make meaningful reforms that work, kind of developing this adversarial relationship where the federal government is going to overwhelm state DMVs with all these new mandates. It's not going to make us safer. It actually may stress the system and lead to breakdowns.
Shai Calvo, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Shai Calvo is Transportation Committee Director for the National Conference of State Legislatures. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Well, stay with us. Alison Brown is the answer. The question, what is a progressive banjoist? There's more ahead here and now.
Thank you. New Line Cinema, presenting the new comedy Monster-in-Law. A woman finally meets the right guy. Unfortunately, he has the wrong mother. Starring Jane Fonda and Jennifer Lopez in theaters Friday.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And when I learned we were going to hear some banjo music today, I thought, well, that's nice. Maybe a little Ralph Stanley or some Bill Monroe. But boy, this is not your grandfather's banjo. Grammy Award winner Alison Brown says she's a progressive banjoist. She once worked as an investment banker for the financial institution Smith Barney before landing a job as banjo player for Union Station. Yes, that Union Station, the backing band to bluegrass superstar Alison Krauss. Now, with several CDs of her own under her belt, Alison Brown is back with a new one, Stolen Moments. That's The Sound of Summer Running from Alison Brown's new CD, Stolen Moments. And Alison joins us from the Sirius Satellite Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And I have been trying to describe your music to friends. How would you describe it?
Oh, I guess it's a girl's take on the five-string banjo.
You have it. Progressive, I've heard.
Progressive, certainly. It's a hybrid sound. I love bluegrass music, of course, but I love all kinds of acoustic music, and my playing is really a blend of all the different things that I listen to.
Right. And we understand that your parents weren't entirely happy when you decided to leave, you know, Wall Street and go into banjo playing full time.
No, they paid for 6 years of higher education, so they were less than enthusiastic when I quit my day job.
But as we said, your way around money has come in very handy. You and your husband have co-founded Compass Records, which gives you tremendous independence. I want to hear more about that, but first, how did you meet Alison Krauss?
Oh, well, that story starts in Boston, actually, where I met when I was in at Harvard there. I met Carrie Estrin, who was a local concert promoter, and she put the two of us together. And as it turned out, when Alison was looking for a banjo player back in 1989, she gave me a call and offered me the job.
Voila. And through Alison and your backup work with her band, you met a lot of people in bluegrass, country, folk, some of whom appear on your new CD, Stolen Moments. Let's listen to the Indigo Girls with your version of Homeward Bound.
I'm sitting in a railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one-night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand. Every stop is neatly planned for a bullet and a one-man band.
Alison Brown's version of Homeward Bound from her new CD. It's called Stolen Moments, and there with her, she's playing banjo and singing away the Indigo Girls. You know, it takes a lot to think you can remake Homeward Bound.
You're right, because that's almost an American anthem. I mean, everybody knows that song. But to me, it's like it's a classic male duet, and I thought, what better than to kind of redo it with, to me, the best, you know, female duo that I know.
Right. It's just terrific. And what happens for you, Alison Brown, as a banjo player? When you're listening to rock and roll, when you're listening to, you know, other kinds of music, are you hearing the banjo part that isn't there?
Sometimes. Not all the time, though. But I do think that there are a lot of places that you can use the banjo outside of bluegrass music. And unfortunately, most people think that the banjo just needs to be used during car chase sequences in movies and bank robberies.
Or terrible canoe trips.
Well, there's that, too. I wasn't going to mention that one.
Right. But for you, it's more.
Yeah. You know, I started off trying to compose my own music. And since I'm a banjo player, that music became banjo music. But the ironic part is that it's has, you know, less in common with bluegrass than you would think. It tends to reach into all different kinds of music, and when I've tried to put my music across, it's been very natural for me to incorporate piano or drums or flute or fiddle or mandolin too. Mm.
Mm.
mentioned, you know, it helps you to put together all the sounds that have inspired you. What are some of those influences?
Jazz, of course, which is a lot like bluegrass music in sort of the form and the approach to playing jazz. It's improvised the way bluegrass music is. I've been listening to a lot of Celtic music lately because we do a lot of that through the label, through Compass Records, who put out a lot of Celtic artists. And Latin's, you know, always been an influence for me, and all kinds of folk music.
Well, you mentioned the jazz, and we feel we can hear it in The Pirate Queen. Let's listen to that, another cut from the new CD, Stolen Moons. Alison Brown, in listening to music like this and some of your other cuts, I was thinking, well, it's sort of like if the Pat Metheny group, the early group, had a banjo in it. It does have a jazz influence.
Thank you for saying that. Actually, I love those early Pat Metheny records. And so that kind of music is, you know, a song like The Pirate Queen, you picked very well to illustrate that.
By the way, we mentioned, you were also an investment banker at one time and now have a company that you co-founded with your husband, Compass Records, and still sort of do a lot of the managerial stuff there?
Yes, since I have the MBA, I'm the one who gets to do all the finance and yes, administration stuff for the label, and there's quite a bit of that, so I'm glad I have the background for it.
But, you know, and lucky, because so many artists don't, and then that's why they end up on those shows, you know, Whatever Happened To, talking about
exactly.
Losing all their money. You know, for many, that's an odd combination of different sides of the brain.
I am kind of unique that way. It's kind of a left brain, right brain thing, and a lot of artists, you know, they talk about wanting to start their own label and put their record up on their website, and certainly anybody can have their own record label these days, but they don't appreciate how much, you know, kind of business drudgery kind of work goes into just making sure the bills get paid and, you know, the promotion gets done. And I don't know, for me it's the ideal marriage, being able to play my music and have a record label too, but it's certainly not for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alison Brown, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Before we let you go, we are just fascinated with one of the cuts on your CD. We're going to listen to it. But in the meantime, I want to ask you about the artists on Prayer Wheel. Listed on the liner notes as The Boom Chicks, Thydalia, Oriola, Ovaria, a couple of Hysteria, and they are who?
Well, it's an all-female band that got together at the Telluride Bluegrass Festival in response to all the men who get together at that festival and sit in with each other all weekend long. We wanted to have an outlet for the women to do the same thing. So the Boom Chicks really are Mary Chapin Carpenter, Sally Van Meter playing dobro, Sally Truitt playing bass, and Andrea Zahn playing fiddle and singing harmony.
You don't seem too glad to see me. Is it a bad time?
Alison Brown's new CD, Stolen Moments, will be released tomorrow. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org. Alison, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Don't forget about me. Spin a prayer wheel for me sometimes. Don't let me slip out of your mind. Spin a prayer wheel for me sometimes.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
How about in the next life? Well, that's the best one. Don't forget about me. Don't forget about me. Spin a prayer wheel for me sometimes.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.